I hope you've had a really good day and a half of sessions and of time to catch up with colleagues and to meet new colleagues. I have to say, speaking for myself, this seems to have been a particularly good meeting for reconnecting with people that I hadn't had an opportunity to see in a while, and I hope it's I hope that's one of the things you've all been able to do here. Just before we move on to our closing plenary, there are a couple of things that I do want to do. Let me remind you that in your packet there are a number of bits of paper that have dates of things on them. That includes our fall meeting, and I hope to see just about everybody here at our fall meeting in December. That will be in Washington, D.C. There is information on our joint meeting with the JISC, which will be in Edinburgh in early July, and I hope at least a few of the folks here will be able to join us for that. There's also information on a couple of other things, including how to get on CNI Announce if for some reason you're not subscribed to it. I would urge you to do so and use that to help keep track of some of the things that we're doing here. I'd like to take a moment to thank a few folks. Notably, I'd like to call for a round of applause for all of the presenters. We had a tremendous number of breakout sessions here, and at least the ones I sampled, was able to sample, were really super. I think I speak for all of us when I say how much we appreciate people who gave their time and expertise to make those happen, and that we'll appreciate them even more if they remember to share their PowerPoints or other materials so that we can put them up on the website, and those who couldn't get to the sessions can also share in that work. So please join me in a round of applause for our speakers. And I'd also like to thank the CNI staff and for all of their work in making the meeting run smoothly. There's been an awful lot of logistics, and the best kind of logistics are the invisible kind of logistics. I think that mostly these logistics rose to the invisible, and please join me in thanking them for that. And now I get to make an introduction of our closing plenary speaker, who will, I think, bring our session to a flamboyant conclusion and send you away with an awful lot of things to think about. I believe at least some of you have had an opportunity to meet Liz Lyon over the years. She's the director of UKOLN, based at the University of Bath, and has been the author of a number of pretty important reports about e-science, and in particular some of the data management issues around e-science, which have circulated in the UK and in the US and elsewhere over the last few years. She's been one of the real synthesizers of development in that area, as well as running some innovative and pioneering projects herself, or being part of the teams that ran them. One of the things that I think it's helpful to know about Liz, and I'm not going to give you a long bio of Liz's contributions, is that she actually is trained as a research molecular biochemist. So she really has an understanding of what goes on, you know, in laboratories that isn't theoretical. And that's very important, I think, when we talk about e-science, and especially when we talk about the realities of e-science beyond a few kind of marquee projects, and really start thinking about how the lives of working scientists in all disciplines are likely to change, and the interactions between professional scientists, amateur scientists, librarians, data curators, information technologists, and others get rearranged in this brave new world of e-research and e-scholarship. I think that Liz is superbly positioned to give us some wonderful insights into that, and please join me in welcoming her.
I'm going to talk primarily about this report, the Open Science Report, that I published last November. It was commissioned by the JISC, and it looked at a whole range of open science issues. This, as I say, was last November, and it's now April 2010, so things have moved on. There is a set of slides from eResearch Australasia here, which actually keeps quite closely to the report. But the talk that you're going to hear now is a completely new one and builds on the information in the report. So please, if you haven't read it, download it. I think it's quite a good bedtime read. All right, so I'm going to look at four areas. I'm going to draw on some experience of some projects that I've been involved with, as Cliff has mentioned. I want to start off by thinking about scale. And we've heard quite a lot in various presentations about the data deluge and about issues of data scale. And I want to look at a particular perspective. And the first one that I want to look at is from the perspective of, well, let's think about a scientist in the lab, and in this case, it's a chemist. So it's probably many of you have got chemistry faculty back at your institutions. You'll have chemists working at the coalface, and this chemist happens to be a crystallographer. She is quite a sort of switched-on chemist, because they're using a mobile device to record their laboratory methodologies and their results. So it's like an electronic lab notebook. And in the Open Science Report, there is a little section on electronic lab notebooks. So the crystallographer in the local lab works. They have to think about the chemical structures of the crystals that they're creating, and they want to analyze them, they want to synthesize them, and they want to characterize these crystal structures. And most of the time that works fine, but sometimes they'll have a crystal structure that's particularly difficult. It might be a particularly small crystal structure. And so at that point, they need to use a different service. So they might go to a national crystallographic service, and this one happens to be in Southampton. So I come from Bath, so let's say there's a researcher at Bath at the local lab, and they've got to take their sample to a crystallography service, a national service at the University of Southampton. And so they've got different hardware there, different equipment, bigger scaled equipment, and you know, most of the time they handle the crystal structures, it's fine, but all of a sudden they may also get a crystal structure that's a little difficult to characterize, so they decide to take it to the synchrotron. So this is the synchrotron, the diamond light source in Oxfordshire, and the National Crystallographic Service has got beam time on one of the beam lines there. And they have a whole different set of equipment there, and the sample goes to Oxford and goes through a pipeline process there. And what we find is that there are different workflows in each different place. Your lab probably has a different workflow to the workflow at Southampton or at Bath. And so what we've got here are far from seamless data integration issues. And we've got a new project, and I'm starting with some quite sort of nitty-gritty stuff here, a new project called I2S2, which is funded by the JISC, and we're working with a range of partners to look at these data integration issues across a range of scale. And as you've probably gathered from what I've said so far, we're looking at data integration across geographical boundaries and also across institutional boundaries. And we're looking at some technical metadata issues, but we're also looking at cost-benefit issues. So we're working with Neil Beegri, who's developed the Keeping Research Data Safe model, to look at where, at which points, intervention will realize cost benefits. And I'd like to share with you some early results. So we've been involved in the requirements gathering phase, trying to understand what's actually happening at these different points. And so I'm not going to go through all of this, but if you have a quick scan through, there's some interesting points here which I'll pick out. So the poor old researcher back at the coalface has to fill in multiple proposals, multiple forms in order to get their sample through these various channels, whether it's at the coalface, whether it's at the national service, or whether it's at an international global service like Diamond. We have a fairly well-established metadata schema as part of the eCrystals National Service at Southampton, but there's variable standards, different metadata used in other sites. As I say, the workflow varies from lab to lab. Some of it is reasonably formulaic, being crystallography, but some of it's quite complex and unrecorded. And for my mind, worst of all, people take their data samples, their crystal samples, to these facilities. They get data off the beamline, and there's millions, billions of pounds invested in these services, but we take our data off on a USB stick. How safe is that? Or on a laptop? So this whole project has raised a lot of issues that we're starting to address with the hope of streamlining and overcoming some of these challenges of scale. So that's crystallography. So what I'd like to do now is to move field slightly and think about some bio stuff. And this time I'm going to go up the coast, I think, if my geography serves me right, to the Broad Institute, which is part of MIT and Harvard, which is a genome center. There's a very nice display here in the atrium of the Broad, where you can actually see the data flying off the sequencing machines. And at the moment, they're sequencing the genome of the African elephant. So they've got 117 sequences, sequencing machines, each churning out 96 parallel streams of data. Let's get the right button this time. Just to give you, I don't know if you, can you see that all right in the back? It's coming out a bit strange here. But there are streams of data here coming out. So you're probably aware that the human genome was first sequenced back in 2000. And they were using first-generation sequences then. And the sort of sequences that they've got at the Broad are Illumina sequences, which are second generation. And you can probably see from the table up here from Nature that the costs are coming down. But now they're thinking about third generation sequences, and there's a whole range of new companies coming into the market with new technologies to try and sequence faster, quicker, and cheaper than before. And this is resulting in a technology race to the market, and the real goal is to sequence a human genome for under $1,000. And some of the companies are promising this within the next few years as well. So what does this mean for us who have to think about managing some of this data and providing cyber infrastructure to manage the data and services associated with that? Well, there are a number of requirements for data storage that we need. And I've listed some of them up there. They're fairly obvious, really. It has to be cost effective, it has to be secure, but equally, we need to be able to port data to and from different services easily. We need to be able to analyze the data so that we can get new knowledge from it. And ideally, what we'd really like to do is move genome sequencing out of these big data centers, and maybe you can sit at your local coffee shop with your laptop and do a quick bit of genome sequencing at your leisure. So enter the cavalry of cloud services, and I've sat in a few sessions that have been talking about cloud computing. And there's quite a lot of hype, a lot of media coverage for cloud computing services, and all the big players are there, Amazon, IBM, Microsoft. They're all there, and they are developing services relatively rapidly to help computing services and data services manage their data. Not all, I should say, of the hype and the media coverage is good, as you'll see from the bottom right-hand corner there. And this table, I hope you can see it in the back, but this table from Nature Biotechnology shows that there is a real ramping up of the companies that are providing cloud storage for bio, for pharma companies. And there's an increasing range of services being supplied and an increasing range of clients as well using those services. So over here on this column, we can see all the people that I've just mentioned, the blue chip players, a range of services being offered. And here on the right, you can see some of the big farmers and the smaller startup companies that are actually buying into these services. So Eli Lilly, Johnson & Johnson, US Department of Energy, they're all there. And they're actually using these cloud services to manage biodata. And interestingly, I think this is probably the first, if not one of the first, published articles that describes sequencing. And in fact, it's looking for single nucleotide polymorphism, in other words, DNA variation in a sequence, using cloud computing. And this came out in late 2009. And you'll see that, in fact, this has been published by colleagues up the road in Baltimore. And it's using Amazon Elastic Cloud Services and some open source software called Crossbow. So it's actually happening. And I mentioned that the first human genome was sequenced back in 2000. So we're now a decade on. And you may have seen that Nature's just produced a really nice special issue commemorating the first decade post-genome. And you can see from the nice graphic here that the cost, as I say, is declining, but the number of human genomes sequenced is increasing. And there are now about 24 published human genomes and over 200 that are unpublished. They've been sequenced, but they're not published yet. So real growth. So what does this actually mean? Well, this is Leroy Hood. And he's the director of the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle. And he's a man with a vision. And he's thinking about how the advent of more widely available genomic data is going to affect the treatment of disease and how we approach health and therapy. And he's got a concept of P4 medicine. So he thinks that it's going to be predictive, personalized, preventive, and participatory. And this is radically different to how medicine is right now. So he envisages a world where every patient's genome will be sequenced. Your genome will be the basis of your medical record. And this means that once you have the patient's genome, you can start to predict what sort of diseases they may be susceptible to. And you can actually treat the patient on an individual basis rather than treating the disease as a whole. That's radically different to how we approach medicine right now. And for those of you that are in an institution that has a medical faculty or some bio faculty, this will impact on how you start to think about information support and research data management support. And there's an article just come out in Science, which is from his lab, his colleagues, where they've sequenced the genomes of a complete family of four, so both parents and the boy and the girl, to start to identify traits and dispositions to particular disease. So this is a real sort of first, if you like. So thinking about scale, which is where we started, we need to think about genome scale biology and what that is going to mean for all of us providing information services and data service support to faculty in that area. And we have to think about genomic data as a commodity, which really radically changes how we think about data in this particular context. Now, this is a slightly different project. This is Sage BioNetworks, and I've been privileged to be part of this new initiative. This is Stephen Friend, and he used to work for Merck Pharmaceuticals, big company, and he left Merck to set up Sage BioNetworks, which is a not-for-profit enterprise, and he's also a man with a vision. And his vision is that a whole load of clinical data, genetics data, genome data will be openly available for sharing between scientists in the Sage Commons. And he's thinking about cancer data, obesity data, diabetes data, all freely available in a way that it's not at the moment for scientists to share, to mine, to interrogate, and to gain new knowledge from it. And there's a congress in a week or so's time in San Francisco where some of the developments that we've been working on for the Sage Commons will be shared. And very interestingly, just this morning in the Wall Street Journal, today's Wall Street Journal, there's an article written and with an interview with Stephen called My Data, Your Data, Our Data. And it's all about the Sage initiative and some associated initiatives. And I'd just like to read to you the last paragraph. So I'll just get somewhere where I can see. Many of the scientists agree it will be increasingly difficult for their colleagues to resist cultural forces that insist on more sharing. My son is four. By the time he's 15, his genomic data will probably be on Facebook. So what they're saying here is that the way people's leisure lives are conducted is actually affecting scientific research. So if patients demand their data be shared, scientists almost have no choice. So again, if you have faculty in the medical area or in the bio area, these sorts of trends will affect you. And there are already a whole bunch of people who have shared their personal genomic data. And the number's increasing. This is one of the more high-profile gentlemen who have shared their data. This is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And there are also increasingly a number of personal genomics companies. You may have heard of 23andMe, DecodeMe, where if you spend about $400, send it off to 23andMe, you get a kit, you send them a saliva sample, and they will analyze your genomic data from that sample. And people are customers are sharing their data on the web in a very, very open way. I think it raises some really, really interesting questions of ethics, of privacy, that your ethics committees in your institutions will need to start thinking about if they're not already. But of course, as we know only too well, many researchers do not want to share their data. They will not share their data, and there are a whole bunch of reasons for that, and some of them I cover in the Open Science Report, and some of them are perfectly valid. It may be because the data isn't ready to be shared. It may be because it's sensitive data, whatever. But also, as this RIN report, the Research Information Network report from last year, where they did a number of case studies from the life sciences, researchers are also extremely reluctant to use other people's data. They don't trust each other. They won't share their data because they don't trust each other and they won't use other people's data. So there's some real interesting cultural issues to overcome there. Okay. On we go. So what can we do to help people to share their data and to make it worth their while? And in the Open Science report, there's a section on rewards, on incentive, credentials, around citation and attribution. And I just want to say a few words today about that. So in recent issues of Nature Biotechnology, Nature Cell Biology, there have been calls for action around how to make data citable and how to be able to attribute ownership and provenance to that data. And in the sessions that I've been to at this conference, I've also heard a lot of discussion about citation of data sets and associated supplementary information. And in PLOS, Computational Biology, last year, there was an attempt to develop a metric that took citation of data sets, blog postings, wiki entries into account as a new metric, and they called it the scholar factor, a new metric to help to attract contributions and participation and data sharing. And if we start to think about citation, we can think about levels of granularity. And we're used to metrics for journals. PLOS talks about article-level metrics. But in the sessions I've been to, we've been hearing about citing data. And of course, it's hugely complex. We have very large databases. We have data sets. We have data elements in tables. So there's a big question for me about what level of granularity do you need to be able to provide citation services? Do you need to be able to cite an annotation? So many of these genome sequences are annotated. Do you need to be able to cite an annotation? And then there's an initiative called the Concept Web Alliance, where they're thinking about how a concept can be described in RDF by a number of triples. And Bernd Mons and Jan Veltrop talk about nanopublications and nanocitations and microattribution. So what level of granularity do we need to have functionality to be able to cite at a level which delivers the services and the attribution that we need? And I went to the presentation about DataCite. I've heard reference to ORCID. There are a number of different services that we can start to draw on which are providing persistent identification to enable these services to be delivered. But the complexity challenges are considerable. Let me give you an example. I'd like to go back to SAGE. So SAGE is all about sharing network models, and I talked about network biology. And Stephen Friend envisages the sharing of multiple data sets, might be genetic data, might be clinical data, environmental data, which are interrelated to see what the variation and the implications are from one data set to another, which affect a patient's disease prognosis. And these are displayed as network models, as visualizations, if you like, using Cytoscape, which is a visualization tool. And that's a sort of typical network. So how do you cite that? This is the work that we're looking at. We're just beginning it. It is very much preliminary. And the first thing we have to do is to understand the workflow of the biologists, of the clinicians that are creating this data, and understand what their requirements are in the citation process. So this work, as I say, is just beginning. We're hoping to talk to some of the modelers and to some of the scientists in San Francisco at the SAGE Congress, and hopefully we'll be able to share some of those results with you. But I think this conveys the complexity of the citation requirement and the attribution requirement. So SAGE is very much a participatory initiative. And what I'd like to do now is to look at some of the different ways in which participation for data curation is being addressed. In the Open Science Report, I try to get a handle on what we mean by openness. And so far in this talk, I've been thinking about access and data sharing, which is what you see along the x-axis here. But openness can also be about participation. And that's what I've tried to display up the y-axis here. So we can think about the lone scholar, not always in the humanities, sometimes in the humanities. And we can think about volunteers and interested amateurs being participating in some sort of science initiative. And we can think about citizen scientists, the public, being involved in science. And there are a number of different projects which are presented here. It's just a selection, if you like, which we can position on this curve, on this continuum, depending on how open they are. But it's not just about this. Here's a different graph. If we think about the amount of work, all the functions, all the services, all the effort, all the tasks that we need to do in order to manage the research data that's coming out of all these new experimentation procedures, I've listed a few on the right-hand side there. We need services for annotation, audit, data cleansing, metadata schema, ontologies, and so on. There's a whole list of stuff that needs to be done. Who's going to do all that? So down here on the x-axis, we've got some notion of capability. So the scientist, the professional scientist, is the subject expert. They know their data inside out. But they haven't got any time. So they've got the capability, but they don't have any capacity. They don't have the time to do what's needed. And over here, we've got people out there, the public, Galaxy Zoo, great example, who've got real interest, real enthusiasm, and they have the time, but they don't always have the skills. So we've got this dilemma, which I've tried to characterize on this decaying exponential graph, of how do we balance the requirements of capacity and capability to help us to curate and manage the data that's being thrown at us today. So as I say, let's look at some examples, some possible approaches. So this is Wiki Pathways. So this is a wiki-based initiative where biologists are sharing their metabolic pathways. So it's an absolutely traditional wiki. You can edit it, you can comment on it, you can add to it. And it's growing. There are, I think, about 1,000 pathways, metabolic pathways, being shared, and about 1,000 users. That's pretty much a handful. But it's a start. Let's look at another example. So we go back to crystallography here, and this is ChemSpider, which is a service from the Royal Society of Chemistry, which manages chemical structures. And they're very much into bringing the community, the crystallography community, the chemists, to help to curate their own data. So they have a manual to help people, a guide. And you can log on as a beta tester, a curator, or a depositor. And as such, you can help to curate the data. So you can edit it, you can add to it, you can tidy it up. And they have a notion of master curators who have oversight. So they check all the work that's done by the curators. So this is quite a nice example, I think, of community curation. Could it be ported to other disciplines? Is it being addressed in other disciplines in this way? I think it's a nice example. And you know, if you've got an iPhone, you can do it on the move. There's an app that allows you to do it on the move. So you can do it sitting on the bus. And also, quite innovatively, I think, they're using gaming approaches to attract people to participate. So they've developed this spectral game, which allows you to, if you like, take part in a sort of semi-competitive way. And they score, they've got top ranking scores, and it's a way of attracting people into participating. So just moving on, if you remember the open continuum, at the top was citizens, citizen science. And in the open science report, there's a whole section on citizen science. And one of the aspects that I particularly liked was a comparison of citizen journalism and citizen science. And what can scientists learn from citizen journalism? And since writing the report, there's a nice blog post from this guy, Martin Bolam. And he's a journalist, but he's also a historian, so he's a citizen historian. And he's got this notion of the curation gap. So he characterized professional journalists, and then he characterized citizen journalists. And I liked this, and I thought, well, we could apply this to scientists. So you can characterize professional scientists in a very similar way. And you can think about enthusiastic amateurs, if you like, the citizen scientists. A whole relatively untapped resource. So let's look at some examples and see what the issues might be. So this is a project which is being led by Intel in Berkeley in California. And they're asking the question, what if every mobile device had an air quality sensor? Okay, so just picture this. You've got your mobile phone, and it's got an air quality sensor in it. So anywhere you go, you can take a reading. And they're developing that hardware. There you are. You can see the very preliminary, I think, hardware there. But their vision is quite exciting. So they envisage that you'll be able to use your mobile device and send in readings from wherever you happen to be. It'll go into a server. They'll synthesize the data. And they'll send you out text messages to tell you where the difficult areas are in terms of air quality in the particular city that you happen to be in. And then they also envisage having signs up in our urban areas telling you which way to walk so that you go in the healthy areas. Okay, and they're calling this participatory urbanism. And I think this is quite interesting. It reminded me of Google Street View in terms of privacy issues. You know, if you happen to suffer from asthma and you have the data sent to you and so on, some interesting privacy issues there. But of course, one person's view on privacy is not necessarily the next person's view on privacy. So there's some interesting areas there to explore, I think, as well, for our ethics committees, who are going to be very busy in the future, I feel. So here's another example, a slightly different example of citizen science. So the BBC has been quite active in this area with an initiative called Lab UK. And the BBC has been looking for particular topics, scientific challenges, that are suited to mass participation. And it's got some quite high-profile scientists, as you can see. There's Robert Winston promoting this approach. And it's starting to have some real success. And one of the things I like about Lab UK is it's working with professional scientists to develop these initiatives. And it publishes a list of criteria so that if you've got an idea as a scientist, you can decide whether it's worth submitting it to see whether they'll take it forward. But better still, they assure that they will publish all the results from these citizen science experiments in peer-reviewed journals. And indeed, they are doing that. And David Attenborough, you can see him on the web promoting the results. So the results of Sex ID have been published in a peer-reviewed journal. So my question really is, how will this go down with your faculty? What are their attitudes going to be to working with the public in this way? I think there's going to be some interesting discussions and deliberations to see whether this is something that your institutions will want to take part in. So that takes us on to the final section that I want to talk about, and to think about how our institutions are responding to these changes that are coming up. And there is a section in the report which starts to look at some of these issues. And this is the University of Edinburgh's informatics building. So this is one way of responding to the growth in informatics. I don't think we're all lucky enough to be able to have a beautiful new building like that. In the Open Science report, I developed a very, very simple checklist, as I called it. So an open science institutional readiness checklist. So it's 10 very quick questions that you can pose to your senior management team to see whether they're on the ball. And if you have a look, it covers strategic planning, it covers structures, policies, and it covers library and information services as well, and how engaged they are with data informatics. And there's a whole section on data informatics in the report. And in this talk, I've covered some of those areas, and I want to draw on some specific examples in this last section to show you some ways in which some institutions are tackling some of these challenges. So, one way that some institutions are tackling high-throughput biology is to concentrate their initiatives and their efforts in some new centres, some new institutes for high-throughput biology. And so UCLA has a centre, University of British Columbia has a centre, and Johns Hopkins has a centre just up the road for high-throughput biology. So this is thinking about gene sequencing, microarray experiments, and concentrating that effort. We heard some talks about cloud computing, and I've said a few words about it. Well, this is quite a nice initiative. So this is from the Triangle Universities, North Carolina, who three of them are collaborating to develop a new cyber infrastructure for data, which is based on cloud computing. So they're going to share their cloud services and develop policies and practice collaboratively for the benefit of all three campuses. So it's a kind of regional solution, if you like. I liked that one. Another thing that some institutions are doing is completely restructuring their information services. So this is Queensland, QUT in Australia, did a presentation last year at eResearch Australasia presenting this new structure. And if you have a look, they're bringing together people like visualizers, high-performance computing people, as well as data librarians, liaison librarians, into an e-research support structure. So again, this is something that your directors of information services or you yourselves may want to consider doing. Now, in the title of the talk was the word constellations, and you're probably thinking, well, she hasn't mentioned constellations yet. So here we are. So at RPI in New York, they have the notion of research constellations, which I rather like. So the idea is that they're bringing together the stars in different disciplines together to work in particular areas. So areas like biocomputation and bioinformatics, tetherless world and integrative systems biology. So multidisciplinary groups, team science. But what I would like to suggest is that doesn't quite go far enough, because given that what we've just been seeing, what about graphic designers to help us deal with these increasingly complex visualizations? Animators to help us use gaming technology to attract punters in, to help us curate our data. I've listed a few ethical and sociocultural issues. We need social scientists in the team to help us with some of those cultural differences. And I know that there are going to be some IPR issues associated with all of this, so we need some legal expertise as well. University of Michigan. So they've got an NSF bit of funding to set up an open data program, and they've got an open data faculty. And if you have a look, it's drawing on people from, again, different disciplines. And they've actually got an open data faculty. So this is, again, thinking about how their institutions are supporting open science. And this article that I referenced earlier from Genome Biology, which is produced from colleagues here locally, if you have a look at where they're from, and I'll have to step closer. So the first author is from the Department of Biostatistics at Johns Hopkins. Second author is from the Center for Bioinformatics. And the third author is from the iSchool at the University of Maryland. That's a really nice combination. So, one of the last points that I want to make is about the changing role of library and information scientists. And in the UK, we have an iSchool now, University of Sheffield. It's the first UK iSchool. And they run courses in chemoinformatics to help the researchers and the new graduate trainees to understand the issues in chemistry. And then Illinois, their iSchool has a course which specializes in data curation. So these are all initiatives to help to develop either faculty or to develop the up-and-coming information scientists and librarians so that they have the skills when they come into our libraries and into our institutions, they have the skills and the knowledge and the know-how to help the researchers to manage their data. So a few take-homes. I'm almost at the end. We need to think of some fairly pragmatic solutions to help the researchers to change their ways, and they have to be embedded in the workflow to help them to share their data so that this prospect of open science can really happen. And I think critical to that is to be able to demonstrate attribution for a particular data sequence, for a particular data set. And we have to work with the funding organizations and the research assessors so that this is built into research assessment frameworks. It's not in the UK research assessment at the moment, and I don't know that it is in the US either. I do strongly believe we need the crowd. We need people to help us. We need effort, we need capacity, and we need to provide tools, interfaces, and guidance and assistance so that we can get the community participating and get citizens out there helping in the way that Galaxy Zoo has been so effective. You all come from a range of different institutions, different characteristics. I hope you'll take back to your institutions some ideas to talk to your colleagues and your peers about how you might address supporting open science, because it is going to change. The prospects, I think, are very exciting. They're slightly frightening as well, but they are transformative. And my last slide is a completely shameless plug for the International Digital Curation Conference, which will happen this year in Chicago in December. And I very much hope that I'll see many of you at that conference. So thank you for listening. Thank you. So I don't know whether anyone has questions. I'm happy to answer a few if you have some.
I have a question about the citizen science angle that you talked about, because citizen science, you promoted that as a concept that we need to leverage, and you hear about that a lot these days. I know the NSF is very interested in it as an approach for data curation, but the scientists that I talk to are incredibly skeptical about that. And there are a couple of good examples that get mentioned every single time, identifying star systems and things like that, but they really don't think that it's going to work for the particular type of science that they do. So, you know, is it really worth pursuing that angle if the scientists themselves won't accept the contributions of amateur scientists because they're not really, you know, vetted? What do you think?
Well, I think we need to do some work to understand what's involved in citizen science, successful citizen science, and think about which disciplines it works for and which disciplines it perhaps isn't right, recognizing that there will be some disciplines, sub-disciplines, where the complexity of the laboratory just doesn't lend itself to someone out there with a web browser contributing. But equally, I think there are other areas where there's real potential. So the Open Science Report really is throwing this idea open and seeking comment and views from both the information science community, but also from the research community, from the funders. And I know certainly from some of the UK research councils, public engagement is high on their list of drivers to show impact. And I don't know if that's also true of US funders. But what better way to demonstrate impact with the public than to get them involved in your research? And school kids, get them involved right from the start so that they understand the process, they understand the skills that they could usefully have, and it becomes second nature to them that they contribute, they manage data. I think it's quite an exciting possibility, but it won't suit everybody. And as with many new things, we need to understand the perspective of the professional scientist who's well established and see where they're coming from as well. I think there's a big discussion to be had in this area, and I hope it will begin now. Okay, I think I'll hand over to Cliff. Thank you.
I thank you very much for that wide-ranging talk. I hope it's left everyone with a good deal to think about. I'll just mention a couple of quick things. One, the pointer to the report that Liz was referring to is on our website and is also in the meeting material that you got, and I do urge you to have a look at it. We will put a pointer up to these slides on the CNI website, and as you probably noticed, they're dense with material and URLs and should be a helpful reference. And I do also want to point you once again to this International Digital Curation Conference that's happening in Chicago. It's the week before the CNI meeting, and CNI is indeed acting as, once again, as we have with all of these, as a co-sponsor. So it's an excellent opportunity for digging farther into some of these issues. Please join me once again in thanking Liz for making the trip over and giving us all of this to think about. And with that, we are adjourned. I wish you safe travels. Perhaps some of you will have a few moments to enjoy Baltimore before you go. And I look forward to seeing you all in the coming months and certainly in December. Thank you for coming.